Rational Faiths Podcasts.
Welcome to Discovering the Old Testament, a series of podcasts exploring one of the primary sources of the Judeo-Christian tradition. I'm your host, Dr. Sheldon Greaves. Welcome to episode 25 of our series, Discovering the Old Testament. In theory, this marks the halfway point of what was intended to be a 50-part podcast. Whether we finish at 50 or go beyond that is yet to be seen. But I want to thank once again those of you who are listening and supporting this podcast. Today's installment is about the Israelite king who followed David, and that was Solomon. Under his reign, Israel truly reached its zenith as a cultural and economic power. Not only did they truly have a king like other nations, Israel herself became very much like other nations, and for some, that eventually proved to be a problem. When David died, he left explicit instructions for his successor, including a list of dangerous persons whom he wanted exiled or executed to keep them from undermining the throne. Solomon carried these instructions out with ruthless efficiency. Solomon further consolidated his position by reaching out to neighboring foreign powers. He concluded a treaty with the Phoenician king Hiram in the north and married a daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt to cement an alliance with them. David had run his kingdom along roughly similar lines to the Egyptian royal court, but Solomon took it much further. And, among other things, he added a new position that had not been part of the Israelite court before, a prime minister. This was just the beginning of a trend in which the kingdom of Israel began more and more to resemble foreign and, perhaps more importantly, foreign polytheistic kingdoms and governments. But in spite of all that, Solomon will always be remembered in Judaism for constructing the temple that bore his name. This was an ambition of his father David, but the prophet Nathan promised David that although he would not build the temple, his son would. As temples go, the Temple of Solomon was not particularly ornate or fancy. The edifice itself was sort of a rectangular box with a tall entry at one end and two pillars on either side of the door. There was an inner court for priests only, and an outer court for everyone else, but there was no wall separating the two. The inner court was slightly elevated and out in the open. Everyone could watch the rituals in progress, unlike most foreign temples, where rituals were usually conducted in secret. After the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BCE, work began on reconstructing the temple about 50 years later, when the Jews returned from exile. That reconstruction went largely along the original lines, but if you look up Temple of Jerusalem, you will probably find images of a much larger and more elaborate building. This was the temple as it was reimagined and expanded by King Herod. It would have been the temple as it was in the time of Jesus. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Solomon's reign has the traditional dates of 970 to 931 BCE. In that time, he built far more than just the temple. There seems to be something about becoming a king back in those days that prompted a mania for building stuff. Up to this point, Jerusalem did not have a city wall, so Solomon built one. He had large chariot divisions stationed at Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, and built bases to accommodate them, and also fortified those cities. Solomon's time also saw the start of a unique style of civic architecture, particularly when it came to city walls and gates. The so-called Solomonic Gate, found at entrances to Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, all have a very characteristic shape. They're built as a kind of short tunnel, with projecting walls inside that jut out part way. These walls have the effect of forming stalls or baffles along the sides, presumably as an additional aid to defense in case the outer doors of the gate were compromised. The work for much of this building was carried out by Phoenician artisans and craftsmen from Tyre and Sidon, along with numerous forced labor gangs all over the kingdom. Those work gangs prompted their share of resentment among the people that built up to a bursting point under Solomon's son Rehoboam. But if Solomon is celebrated for any one thing, it would be his legendary wisdom. 1 Kings 3 records the story of a dream in which God offered to give Solomon whatever he wanted, and this was Solomon's answer, verses 9 through 13. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, able to discern between good and evil, for who can govern this your great people? It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. God said to him, Because you have asked for this, and have not asked for yourself long life or riches, or for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, I now do according to your word. Indeed, I give you a wise and discerning mind. No one like you has been before you, and no one like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor all your life. No other king shall compare with you. Now, if you look at royal inscriptions in the ancient Near East, you'll find quite a few kings bragging about how wise they are, but it seldom rises to the level of being the defining characteristic, the way it was with Solomon. Perhaps the closest parallel we see is that of Hammurabi of Babylon, who predates Solomon by about 1,000 years. He has a lot to say about his wisdom in his famous prologue and epilogue to his law code, but given the context, that's hardly surprising. The signal incident that the Bible uses to portray Solomon's wisdom on display was the dispute between two women who each claimed to be the mother of an infant, where Solomon determines which is the true mother by offering to split the child in half and give half to each woman. If you've read Mark Twain's commentary on this story as part of his narrative in Huckleberry Finn, you'll know that the story has some internal inconsistencies, but that need not bother us here. The point of the story was that Solomon's ability to find his way to the truth of a matter was above and beyond that of ordinary people. The Old Testament also records that Solomon was the author of several thousand songs and proverbs, and that he had knowledge of all plants and animals. This last talent is the basis for a number of charming stories about Solomon's interactions with the animals. In one rabbinic story, it was a bird who made Solomon aware of the land of Sheba and the queen who ruled it. Solomon then sent the bird to the queen of Sheba to request her presence at his court. In later intertestamental writings, such as The Wisdom of Solomon, The Testament of Solomon, and other works, Solomon is depicted as a skilled astronomer and later as a magician of tremendous power who could enslave demons and command them to do his bidding. The book of Ecclesiastes, which is part of what we now call wisdom literature, implies authorship by Solomon, even though it was clearly written much, much later. God's promise to Solomon in his dream also included wealth. Apparently, God's gift of wisdom included some solid business sense, for the wealth of Solomon's kingdom was almost as legendary as his wisdom. He built a fleet of commercial ships based on the shores of the Red Sea to trade with Arabia and East Africa. He was also, you might say, an arms dealer, dealing in chariots and horses between different countries, but notably Asia Minor and Egypt. His skill in acquisition apparently also applied to women. His extensive and varied treaty obligations with other nations included 700 wives and 300 concubines, consisting mostly of members of other royal families. Leaving aside the obvious domestic questions this raises, there were logistic and diplomatic pressures that came in the wake of such a huge household. Even if we assume that these numbers are inflated, which they almost certainly are, keeping such a large number of people in the manner to which they are accustomed would be expensive. It also pressured Solomon to accommodate their religious needs as well. It was this, and his growing love of luxury, that made it all start to come undone. The story of Solomon's greatness runs in 1 Kings from chapters 3 through 10, and if that's all we had, he would look like an incredibly successful and competent king. But chapter 11 represents a tipping point. Solomon's wives are blamed for turning him away from the worship of Yahweh and building temples where these foreign wives could worship their gods, and even joining in himself as a devotee of Ashtarte, a northern Canaanite goddess. He built temples for Chemosh, the gods of the generally hated Moabites, and even a shrine to Molech. This chapter, chapter 11, shows a swift demise, but also serves as an opportunity to remind the reader that Solomon's good fortune was contingent on obedience to God's laws and covenants. This was one of the major themes of what modern scholars call the Deuteronomistic history, of which the Book of Kings is a portion. The ultimate failure and destruction of Israel, Jerusalem, and Solomon's temple originated in the failure of Israel to abide by the terms of their covenant with God. At least, that's the finding of the Deuteronomistic historians. Solomon's kingdom broke in two during the reign of his son Rehoboam. The 10 tribes to the north rebelled and formed their own kingdom, which later was called Israel or sometimes Ephraim. Judah remained as the southern kingdom. I should also point out that much of the popular discontent that led to this severance between north and south grew out of some unwise spending priorities and the taxation that went along with them. For example, we have archaeological evidence that Solomon kept a sizable chariot force, as mentioned earlier. According to the Bible, he owned 12,000 horses with horsemen and 1,400 chariots. One of the facilities for his chariotry has been excavated at Megiddo that included 450 horse stalls, but there is not much evidence that he found himself in any military conflicts with his neighbors until fairly late in his reign. This implies that this military spending may have been as much for prestige as for anything else, since he clearly wasn't bent on conquest. It would have done very little to boost the national economy compared with, say, his investment in commercial shipping. You may recall, back in episode 21, we cited the warning of Samuel about the abuses of kings that Israel would bring down upon herself if she opted for a king like other nations. Most scholars agree that the specific text of this warning was written well after the fact, and that the model was none other than Solomon himself. But there's another point of Solomon's reign that we need to take note of, and that is that the rights and privileges of the individual tribes became consolidated in the person of the king. David had been more circumspect about these rights and was more careful to pay attention to them than his son was. Remember that David was able to unite the tribes by winning them over. The same northern tribes that would bolt from the kingdom under Rehoboam joined David's kingdom willingly, and in fact solicited David to be their king. Solomon, by contrast, redrew borders for his provinces that didn't respect tribal territories, and sometimes would split a tribe across more than one province. He also granted special privileges to the tribe of Judah. The other tribes didn't take this favoritism very well. The tribal leaders were further angered because of Solomon's apparent preference for things foreign and Canaanite over Israelite. This was all the more ironic, since the whole rationale of wanting a king in the first place was to protect Israel from encroachment by aggressive foreign powers, and yet these powers had managed to insinuate themselves into the very administration of the kingdom. Solomon's reign is also interesting from a cultural perspective. It took place during a period of relative peace in the region. The young Assyrian Empire was occupied with enemies elsewhere and so ignored the Semitic peoples of Syro-Palestine. During Solomon's 40-year reign, he used this peace to good advantage from the standpoint of international relations and trade. But it was also a very important formative period for Israelite culture that would have considerable repercussions down through the centuries. The Jewish admiration of intellectual skill, of life wisdom, and the arts of music and poetry arguably draws much from the tradition of Solomon, who, like his father David, is something of a patron saint of Jewish letters and arts. The historicity of Solomon's kingship has taken on some interesting dimensions due to recent scholarship and archaeological research. Most scholars now accept that Solomon was a real person, though the question remains as to the extent of his domain. Scholarly positions range from Solomon being the king over a Jerusalem city-state to claims of a more extensive domain. Archaeologists such as William Deaver, Amnon Ben-Tor, and Kenneth Kitchen have marshaled an extensive body of evidence that shows the main features of the biblical tradition to be generally trustworthy. It now appears more that Solomon ruled over a mini-empire than a city-state. Also, the figures for the amounts of money that passed through his administration are not particularly outrageous when compared with numbers from other comparable kings. Deaver and his colleagues have also challenged the notion that the dimensions for the Temple of Solomon are far in excess of what would be considered plausible. A good case can be made that the dimensions are, in fact, quite reasonable. Unfortunately, we cannot directly test that question, since it would require excavations on the Temple Mount, where all excavations are forbidden for very good reasons. As we've seen in past episodes, the Bible uses history and narrative to make a point, but here the point is not quite as black and white as we might wish. The Old Testament does not have a problem with kings per se, only with kings who misbehave, who step out of line and disobey God. So long as they do what they are supposed to do, things can be pretty good. But there is always the human element, the weakness for power and what it can bring: prestige, self-aggrandizement, power over entire nations, power to let someone live or execute them by a mere gesture. On the other hand, a king might also build the temple that becomes the central, defining religious edifice of an entire nation, making its presence felt even when it lay in ruins. The authors and editors of Kings and other biblical sections that bear on the reign of Solomon and other kings seem to understand when clear-cut judgments were not easily drawn from the stories they tell. Even when they sought to make a point, as often as not, it was a point for further discussion. And welcome back to another splendiferous episode of the Weird and Wild Old Testament. We just finished listening to episode 25, the Solomon's Wisdom. I'm your host, Dr. Sheldon Greaves, and joining me, as always, is the inimitable Miguel Barker Valdez. How you doing, Miguel?
I'm okay. Not great, but I'm okay.
All right. Cool. Well, you know, it's the weekend, so it's okay to kind of slacking out a little bit, I suppose, you know, so. So, you know, we were talking about you know, Solomon and this tradition of, you know, who he was in his historical context, and he was a, you know, probably a historical character, and he was a king, but how big a king was he, and how big was his kingdom? Was it a city-state? Was it a little empire? You know, this all this stuff. But you want to look at the legacy of Solomon, and it's about, you know, him being wise, him being a smart person. And for that, you know, there's just a whole bunch of different directions that we can go. Fortunately, we'll be covering some of that stuff when we get to Proverbs. And maybe again, in, you know, maybe a less direct way when we get to Ecclesiastes, which is technically, incidentally, Ecclesiastes is an example of something that's kind of a borderline pseudepigrapha. It hints that it's written by Solomon, even though it doesn't actually come out and say so. But it's pretty clear from the language and the issues that it's talking about that it's much, much later. But Israel has a kind of an interesting wisdom tradition, and it's not the same as, say, later contemporaries, say the Greeks, you know, Greek philosophy. Greek philosophy tended to be, you know, more about asking questions and reasoning things through. It was more about how to live your life, which Greek philosophy eventually did go and cover, but it was also less grounded in if A, therefore B, you know, logical deductive reasoning. It was more about grounding things in daily life. It was more, you know, experiential. And even so, it was considered to be, you know, the right of the person who was educated. In other words, the person who had the time to sit back and think about things that had happened to them rather than just, you know, going from one experience to the other. We also later on, and obviously this is well, you know, past the time of Solomon, but it's firmly rooted in, the tradition of who and what he was. We have the priest who deals with, you know, the law and purity and all that stuff. And then we have on the other end the prophet, who is kind of this channel for the divine word. And somewhere in between, there's this third alternative that develops called the sage. And the sage is the person who is kind of between the two and is mainly known for giving good advice, you know. So there's, for instance, there's this verse in Jeremiah chapter 18, verse 18, so it's easy to remember. And it says, they're talking about, you know, making a plot against Jeremiah. Then they said, "Come, let us devise plans against Jeremiah. Surely the law is not going to be lost to the priest, nor counsel to the sage, nor the divine word to the prophet. Come on, let us strike at him with our tongue and give us no heed to any of his words." In other words, they lay out these three kind of categories of intelligentsia and what they do. So the priest deals with the law, the counsel, the sage deals with counsel, and the prophet with the divine word. But once you hit the exile, the things that kind of kept all these different people in their separate niches, those things go away. You can't really talk about the priest anymore because you don't have a temple. You can talk about the prophet, but the prophet usually worked in opposition to the king or the high priest, and that isn't there anymore, so they kind of don't have anything to push back against. And the sage is kind of sorting there kind of in the middle. And from about the time of the exile onward, these three intellectual categories start to converge, and they eventually sort of become this wise man, this sage. And Israelite wisdom literature is sort of a very incomplete, somewhat indirect account of what happens and how this all happens. But in that material, Solomon is the archetype of the Israelite sage. So I mentioned before that we have Proverbs, which are mostly attributed to Solomon. We have Ecclesiastes, which is also attributed to Solomon. But then in the Apocrypha, we have this rather lengthy book, I think it's like 19 chapters or something, called The Wisdom of Solomon, that goes in and considers questions about life and death and, you know, what's our purpose and, you know, how does God deal with justly with human beings, and does he in fact, you know, act justly, and how do we know, and all these big question type things. But then as you get further on, later on, you know, in late antiquity and into the medieval period, that's when Solomon gets really interesting, because the idea developed during the intertestamental period and then later on that knowledge, the really juicy kind of knowledge, was the kind of knowledge that allowed you to manipulate aspects of the cosmos. That if you had the right kind of knowledge, you could invoke powers that were normally off limits or at least inaccessible to humans. So this would involve things like entrapping a demon and forcing it to do what you were, you know, what you wanted it to, and
that's good.
It's great. It's like, you know, this is like total Doctor Strange kind of stuff, you know. And the power of Solomon, the wisdom of Solomon was, you know, the proof of his wisdom was the fact that, you know, if a spirit or a demon, if he needed something done, he could always find someone, spirit or demon, to do it for him. And they couldn't do anything about it because he knew that game well enough to play it. Another interesting thing about Solomon that you find in this later literature is that Solomon was kind of a prototype scientist. He was a naturalist type person. He knew the names of all the plants and their properties and the animals and their habits and what they did and what they were useful for and all that kind of thing. So he was also, you know, something of a, he had a kind of a geekiness to him that, was considered a hallmark of wisdom. So Hebrew wisdom literature, it was also very highly individualistic. It really depended on the person and what they were concerned about. I refer to Israelite wisdom literature as late Iron Age Israelite success literature. And it kind of is, you know, it does that. It's concerned with being successful and being prosperous. It also is kind of questioning and kind of skeptical. They like to ask the hard questions. They don't necessarily buy into the fact that if you do everything you're supposed to, everything's going to work out just fine. Which is kind of amazing to me. I mean, Ecclesiastes is just loaded with that kind of skepticism. And it's something of a wonder that it did manage to find its way into the biblical canon, but it was a bit late to the party. And I think part of the reason why it took a while for that to happen is because it is really skeptical and it does ask hard questions and it doesn't necessarily offer satisfactory answers. There's also this interesting bit about wisdom personified. Wisdom has the name Sophia, which incidentally is the name of the cat everyone heard purring in the last episode. Sophia is this female presence. She's very distinctly female. She kind of works beside God. She existed in the beginning. She took part in the creation. She seeks to, well, she will convey knowledge to those who seek after her, and she's often associated with some kind of divine feminine. Obviously, this was kind of a difficult thing for, monotheistic Judaism, but somehow she managed to slip in there too. I suppose, if you can read it as metaphorical, you can get away with anything. And maybe that's how they did it. I don't know. But this is also in this late period, after the exile, or well, during and after the exile, but before the New Testament, you start seeing a lot of speculation about what happens after we die. And this is where there's a lot of speculation about the afterlife and where the spirit goes, but also about the resurrection. It's really during the intertestamental period that you start to see serious questions and speculation raised about the possibility of a resurrection. There's also a big question about, well, what happens after you die if you were good? What happens if you die after you die if you were bad? The idea of a judgment suddenly becomes a lot more prominent and a lot more detailed during this period too. But that's also part of the wisdom tradition. So, wisdom, it's a huge topic, but you could start, if you start with the wisdom of Solomon and Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, and I guess also maybe the wisdom of Ben Sira, which is another book in the Apocrypha. And there's other, wisdom literature too that you'll find in the intertestamental period, but those are the big ones. And then if you want to get to into the medieval stuff, well, I suppose there's the Key of Solomon, which I have never read deeply, but it looks like it's a whole lot of, maybe you can make it part of a, Dungeons and Dragons session or something like that. I don't know.
Dungeons and Dragons session.
Yeah. Hey, wasted a lot of time doing that. Solomon's wisdom is an active agent in the history of Israel. It's a respected tradition, and I find it kind of interesting that in Mormonism, there's been from time to time this surge of interest in things intellectual, and the fact that most of the religious movements that came out of the Second Great Awakening, among whom Mormonism was one of them, tended to have a very anti-intellectual strain because they were rebelling against the cerebral deism of the founding fathers. But Mormonism kind of went the other direction. I mean, it reached a point where they get to Salt Lake and they pretty much are obligated to set up a research university almost as a theological mandate. So, and of course, Brigham Young has all kinds of, interesting and occasionally inspiring and sometimes perplexing things to say about education, but, that's Brigham for you. But he was clearly very interested in it, and it mattered to him. So, there you go. Wisdom. Gotta love it.
Do you remember the article written by Barney Kevin in Dialogue? I can't remember which issue it was, but, it's called How to Worship Our Mother in Heaven Without Getting Excommunicated.
I know of it, but I haven't read it. I'd forgotten about that one. I think I need to go give that a read.
So one of his ideas is to name your children, like if you have a daughter, Sophia.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, that'll do it.
So when you mention that, It kind of reminded me of his article, the dialogue article. And so in the canonized scripture, do we have any other stories of Solomon being wise other than, you know, chopping the kid in half?
Oh, boy.
Because the reason I ask is, like, it shows that, but he doesn't seem to make wise choices.
No, he does some pretty stupid things. It's true. I mean, you know, with what, you know, how many hundred wives and concubines? I mean, at that point, geez, come on, you know, they're not spouses. They're fashion accessories by that point, you know. You know, it's funny because, Samuel and Kings really, they talk about, Solomon a lot in terms of his commercial success, you know, that he made a lot of money, you know, he was a sharp bargainer and that sort of thing. What I find interesting is that they ascribe his financial success to his wisdom, or at least that's the impression that I get, whereas we have a tendency to ascribe financial success to righteousness. And the two are not the same.
Yeah, you're right. You kind of, yeah. Unfortunately, Mormonism has gotten a little bit of the prosperity gospel in there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's unfortunate. So there is that. And, there's also a section in there, somewhere where it talks about, you know, how he wrote so many thousand proverbs and so many thousand songs and, you know, a bunch of other things that indicate that he left some kind of legacy of wisdom literature. Of course, obviously, if that stuff existed, we don't have it now, obviously. But that said, the scholarly consensus is leaning more and more towards the idea that Solomon was a real person. We just don't have the details yet. But that's archaeology. Archaeology uncovers civilizations, not people, not individuals.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
You know, you go looking for some person. The only way you're going to do that is if they left some, you know, like massive tomb or something like that. And even then, you're not likely to find out. We still don't know where Alexander the Great was buried.
Oh, he's... You might not know this.
Uh-huh.
Buried underneath the Joseph Smith Sphinx. That's there in Salt Lake.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, I have wanted to go and see that. I know it's there somewhere, and every time I go to Salt Lake, I keep thinking, I need to go visit that, and I keep forgetting. Because, man, that's, you know... I mean, if the slogan of rational faith is keeping Mormonism weird, that really needs to be part of your, part of your branding somehow. I don't know how you do it.
That's funny. Yeah. That's funny. You know what got me thinking too is how Solomon plays a prominent role in the mythos of Freemasonry as well.
That's true.
kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, Freemasonry is about hidden knowledge, secret knowledge. And, you know, Solomon is kind of the poster child for that.
Yeah, and thank goodness we know that from Nicolas Cage and his great movie National – what was that called?
National Treasure,
yeah.
Oh yeah, my God! What would we do? What would we do without people like that? You know? No, that was one I skipped. I mean, usually I'll at least, you know, check out some movies like that, like, you know, The Mummy or Stargate or whatever, and it's good, clean fun and everything. But that just looked way too cheesy to even, you know. So okay. So did I miss anything?
Actually, I liked it. And my daughter's like,
oh, okay.
You're not hurting my feelings at all. And I'm not saying, you know, go out and watch it. There's other much better movies that I would actually recommend. But yeah, it's one of those movies that we decided to watch with the girls and they liked it. Right now, my wife and I This has nothing to do with the podcast. My wife and I are trying to remember funny comedies that were movies when we were kids. And so I think it's time to introduce them to So I Married an Axe Murderer. That will be the next one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we were all kind of raised on the Marx Brothers. I mean, it was kind of a family, you know, initiation. You'd have to sit down and watch Duck Soup, you know, a lot of Day at the Races. So when we all gather together for, like, for holidays, it's the Greaves family gathering, but it's also kind of a Marx Brothers film festival.
Oh, really?
Because they're always going on the TV
or
whatever.
That's funny, man.
Yeah. Another good one that we loved was The Great Race. Did you ever see that one with Tony Curtis, Natalie Wood, Jack Lemmon?
No, I didn't. Peter I haven't Falk. Seen that.
Oh God, it's hilarious. I mean, it's a kind of a stereotypical, almost like a melodrama, complete with, you know, the black hat and the white hat guy. But oh man, it's funny. It's just insanely funny. Anyway, I'm sure Solomon had a good sense of humor too. That's how we're tying.
nice segue, dude.
Yeah. So I don't know. Do you have any other questions? There really isn't a whole lot to add
to this. Not really. I don't have anything.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, I've done most of the talking here, so why don't you take us out?
For sure. Remember that when reading scripture, history is not the point. Oh, hold on. I'm going to actually. What point is being made here with Solomon? I missed it. Even in your thing, actually go, it's not super clear. Yeah, what is the point? I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, he's kind of an advocate that spirituality has to have an intellectual side. You know, you have to be thoughtful. It's not enough to be, to be pious and go through all the forms. When Solomon, when God says to Solomon, "I'll give you whatever you want." And, you know, you want power, you'll have power. You want money, you'll have money. You want long life, you got long life. Tell me what you want. And Solomon says, "I want wisdom." And God says, "Good answer. You're going to get that plus all the others."
Okay.
So, you know, it's kind of a nice thing to go back to when you get hit with the bias that we all too often see both in Mormonism and in other Christian religions, that the intellect is something to be avoided, and it's a bad thing, and it's scary, and it will, you know, turn you evil or something.
Oh, okay. All right. So
how's that?
Well,
that,
yeah, thanks. That will, okay. That was good.
I should have mentioned that earlier, but it just, you know, needed to percolate up.
Well, you touched on it in the podcast that everyone listens to, before discussing or maybe not discussing it, but I couldn't remember what you said. Oh, I forgot to tell you,
right.
On the ratings, on the Rational Faith ratings, there was one guy that I can't find it now, but he's like, okay, we get the idea. You went to Berkeley or something like that. I'm like, and I was thinking, like, you don't mention it that often.
I don't think I do. Well, I don't know. It was an important part of my life. Yeah. So, you know,
exactly.
Whatever.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's super funny.
So,
All right. So I shall take us out now.
All right. Yeah.
Wait, hold on a second.
Oh,
so that makes no sense. Actually, I was going to read the actual thing to you, but I can't find it. All right. Here you go. So, thanks for hanging out with us. And remember that when reading scripture, history is not the point, but rather history is being used to make a point.
There it is. All right. Thanks, Miguel. We'll see you next time. Bye.
If you enjoy the content of this podcast or any of the other Rational Faith podcasts, head over to iTunes or Stitcher and leave a nice review. That way, more smart and beautiful people like you can find us.